the podcast about people. I'm your host, David E. Bowman. This episode of Voices features a conversation with Patricia Ryan Madsen, author of Improv Wisdom, a book that shows how to apply the maxims of improvisational theater to real-life challenges. Listen along as Patricia discusses the principles of improv, why they matter, and how you can use them to enrich every aspect of your life. My guest today, all the way from California, is Patricia Ryan Madsen, author of the book Improv Wisdom, a wonderful book about how people can get greater fulfillment in life by applying the principles of improvisation. Patricia, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. It's good to be talking to you, David.
It is wonderful to be talking to you. Let me start just by saying I'll take one of the tips from your book and say thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, I appreciate that. I heard from you via email with a thank you for my book, and that really meant a lot. So you're most welcome. It's people that are appreciating and noticing the gifts that we have in the world that are doing a lot of good, I think. So you're most welcome.
Well, thank you again. I love the book Improv Wisdom. I think it is very well written. It's full of great advice that is both easy to understand and really easy to implement for, me, for anyone that's, even if you're not an actor or a classically trained performer, it's the type of book that you can read and it just makes sense. And there are hundreds of things in there that you can actually just do to make life more fun.
I'm glad to hear that because for some people, the title Improv Wisdom might be a kind of a turnoff. They might think something like, oh, improvisation, yeah, that's for those funny people, Robin Williams and the comics, but I don't do that stuff. But it really is a book for everyone in the guise of an improv manual. My hope was to reach people just like yourself, business persons and housewives and artists and retired people, with advice that is sort of comes out of the study of improvisation, because that's what I've done as a teacher for a long time at Stanford, to take the principles that we use in order to stand up and make up stories in front of an audience. How can the things that we learn to do that be useful in our everyday life? And so the book was really a poem to everyone, and it really makes me happy that that you've found it despite the title in a way.
Well, what are some of the principles of improv and why would they matter to people besides actors and performers?
Well, I think that the foundation principle upon which all improvising is based is the notion of saying yes and not blocking what's coming your way. I think in ordinary life we have a tendency, whatever comes our way, to first analyze it and decide whether it's good or bad, whether I agree with this or not. So there's a way in which we assess and judge the world as it comes at us, and then act after the judgment. And that's normal. There's nothing really wrong with that process, and it helps us because a lot of times we have to make a judgment call before acting or reacting. The improv way, which seems kind of crazy, is to accept everything that comes your way and work with it and build on it. And that's really not that crazy a principle to live your life by. It means that even the problems that come your way can become opportunities, that everything is an offer, and instead of judging it and possibly rejecting it or setting aside, throwing in your better idea, you take what is given and work with it, and then build on that. It's a way, I think, of not letting your preconceptions run the show. We all have them, but an improviser is open to the last thing that's just been said or done and wants to capitalize on that. And I think that's a good principle to work with. So the principle of saying yes and not blocking or negating things that come up is really the keystone, really the fundamental way that improv works. That's how two players can get on stage and it looks like they're telepathic, or they must have been doing a story that they've agreed on before. Let's do number 26, the story about the dog. What they do is one person steps up and says, "Hey, nice schnauzer you've got there." And instead of arguing that, or the other player is going to agree, "You bet, he just won the prize in the contest. You want to see him do a trick?" So that we take what's given, accept it, and build on it. That's separate from our likes and dislikes. So I think that's one of the key things we can learn from improv. The other thing is that improvisers, in order to make something out of anything, are not spending any time trying to think outside the box, which may be counterintuitive, because we often sort of define creativity as something that's outside the box that no one else is thinking about. An improviser looks at what everybody is thinking about, what's completely in the box, what is most obvious in this moment, and seizes on that and then works with that idea and develops it. So it's this notion of being obvious or being average. One of my teachers, a wonderful improv guru named Keith Johnstone, who wrote the book Impro, the quote that I love of his is, "Dare to be dull." And I think that sounds odd, but he's always inviting his students to just be average. Let's do an average scene here, taking the pressure off of the students to come up with something that's going to be funny or good or whatever. And as soon as you take that pressure off, the natural mind that can see and understand things, that uses all of our own resources, can come into play. And we're free to let the well of the creative, the grist along with the gems, come flowing through. Do you know what I mean by that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. There's some way that we, any great idea or anything well done is likely to be a product of a lot of things that didn't work. So another improv rule is to make mistakes. Please. You don't want to avoid mistakes. You want a bunch of them. There's all kinds of data that, I think this isn't that revolutionary a principle, that anyone in the creative work recognizes that things that go awry are often your greatest friends. And so for an artist, it takes maybe 100 pieces of doing them before that gem comes through. But you got to keep doing stuff for the real high work of art to emerge. But you don't wait until the high work of art kind of pops into your head before you put the brush to the canvas. The idea of doing a lot, and some of it is artful, and some of it is practice or interesting. So in the creative process, I think the most important thing is the act of doing it. Be proactive in your, don't wait until the idea is perfected. Because we can think ourselves or reason ourselves into a corner on any project before anything gets rendered. So the improviser sort of ready, fire, aim is the modality. Do something without being sure that it's quite right, and you see where it goes, and then you adjust from there. So action itself is a great teacher.
Yeah, and taking action and discovering that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. That's right. How do you see these applying to your work, for example?
Well, you know, I think in general in the business world, so for example, I think there's so much application relative to the use of improv. So we spend so much time planning and so much time analyzing and, you know, putting together these scenarios that never go according to plan. But it's the ability to manage what do we do when things go wrong? What do we do when things go better than expected? How do we handle these changing situations in an extremely dynamic world? I mean, now more than ever, change happens so rapidly that the ability to say yes and continue to run and just say, we're going to figure this out as we're going. And even if you fail, fail quickly, realize it, and move on. Is so valuable. I mean, I think you look at a company like Google, and I think they embody that idea.
They really do. And they're poised, I think, to keep moving and trying and staying agreeable and putting their fingers in a lot of pies. And there is that sense. I've actually taught at Google and did a lecture, a Google author talk at one point. And when you walk into that building, there's the sense that action is going on. They're not just sitting in boardrooms just analyzing and deciding into the future. There's a lot of hands-on stuff that's being tried. I think you're right that this century, more than ever before in history, is for the malleable, and that the qualities that make a good improviser are going to help in every way, in business and in personal life. I know that the improvisers that I work with and that I play with are among the greatest people to be around, because they carry with them a positive spirit, and I think that's the notion of yes and embodies that. It's great to be around can-do people who are going to listen to your idea and then think of how to riff off of it and develop it, make it better, rather than who are sitting ready to judge why we can't afford to do that or it's probably not going to work.
Well, yeah, it's
the naysayers just don't have any place in the improv world. They're not going to last very long. But I don't know. Some people are born with a sort of positive perspective on the world, but I really believe you can develop it. I see that in classes where a lot of skeptical folks show up, as they did last night at Stanford, with their arms crossed, standing in a circle, wondering what this crazy lady is asking them to do. And if they stay with that class in 10 weeks, I can assure you that the scowl is gone, and instead of having their arms folded, their arms are dangling by their sides, ready to catch a ball or do something. And there's a smile on their face and a readiness to, hey, let's see what's up. And that's the kind of mind-body set that is going to be so useful. And it's easier to go through the world with a smile, which is not to say that everything that happens is good. We're going through incredibly difficult times now. Economically and in the world, but somehow I even think about the earthquake in Haiti that's going on. The pictures we've just been seeing of the devastation. How do you move through that with if you will, maybe not a smile, but certainly with a can-do attitude? What's going to be possible? How to use the mind, body, and the resources at hand to try to make the situation better? And that's improvisation actually is what we fall into when there is some kind of a crisis, because there's not a set of rules of what to do or how to make it better, but we're trying to make it better.
Well, and it's, you know, surprisingly, it sounds very similar to some of the work of Stephen Covey, who I think borrowed some from Viktor Frankl as well in terms of behavioral psychology, but the idea that, you know, but from the time an external stimulus happens to your response to that, you have a choice in terms of how you respond. And I think instinctively many of us, you know, that response is no, or that response is, you know, we sort of go into a shell, whereas you have an ability to choose how you react. And I think improv is teaching you, hey, there's a different way to react, a yes way to react.
Yes, precisely. And I think that's true, that the blocking or the no response is so normal in a way, because it's safe. When you stand off or wait or say I don't know or no to anything, you seem to protect yourself. So it can be a habit that is ingrained that you may not even know is controlling your life. I think people find that when they study in an improv class, they discover something like, oh my gosh, I almost always block in that situation, or but never thinking of it in that way. We play a game where we have to plan something together, a date or a weekend or a party, and the first we try planning it together with using the critical mind, seeing if you can find problems or fault with the other person's ideas, and so they go on and on. It ends up being the kind of conversation that we often have no, I don't think that'll work, or I can't quite afford that, or she doesn't like going there, or whatever. And then we do the same exercise, but the rule is that you have to agree with the last thing that was said and build on it. So you can't block or defer. You need to see what happens when you co-create something. Because when you think about it, there is so much in life that the specific content itself isn't really what's important. But the way of working together and the manner of creating an environment where two people are sharing the fun of co-creation, making something, it sort of almost doesn't matter which movie we go to if we agree to go and have a good time. So I think folks can learn how to find that positive way of responding. And I think the comparisons to Frankl's work, et cetera, and Covey are wonderful. I'm really honored to be in the company of those great writers.
Well, one of the other topics you touch on, and I think this may be a surprise to those who have never read your book or read anything about improv, but you talk a lot about the idea of being present, being fully in the moment. And I think, you know, sometimes when we think about improv or whatever, we sort of think of some, you know, the daydreaming kid in the corner who's goofing off and not paying attention and just kind of, yeah, winging it, whatever. But really, it couldn't be further from the truth.
That's right. It's the opposite. It's not that daydream thinking of something clever, but it's almost a Zen-like attention to the present moment. I mean, this notion of being in the moment is something that's a kind of a catchphrase these days and comes out of certain Eastern psychology, Eastern martial arts, and whatnot. But it's as time-honored, it's not necessarily Eastern. It's as American as the fact that your great-grandparents on a farm somewhere in Ohio, if they were intimately attentive to the weather and all sorts of things. You had to pay attention to what's happening in reality, in your world right now, in order to survive. And I think all the modern creature comforts that we have, the things that do stuff for us, maybe have deferred us from paying attention to the physical world around us. So a great improviser is someone who is noticing the expression on everyone's face in the room, is noticing the temperature of the room, is paying attention in a way that is very much alive and alert. And certainly this aspect of improvising may be one of the most valuable life skills, because none of us pays attention as well as we could. I think we can all get that attention muscle more highly exercised. And a lot of improv work is really paying attention. We play a game where one player talks for 3 minutes and tells a story that has a lot of details. The partner that's listening listens with complete attention, and then when the storyteller stops, the partner then has to repeat back verbatim everything that was said in the first person, has to reproduce that 3-minute talk right on the spot. Now, nobody does that perfectly, but if you imagine that you're going to be listening to this conversation such that you could repeat it word for word, detail for detail, you'd listen with a different quality of attention. And so that's what we train people to do, is to listen harder than they ever have before. And that's it's a great skill to know, because we're often in our own mind thinking and ruminating and deciding what we're going to say rather than hearing the detail of what the other person is saying. But an improviser has to know what's going on in order to go forward.
So who are your favorite improvisers? It could be, you know, from performers to politicians to who do you think exemplifies improvisation?
That's a great question. Well, out here in the Bay Area, there are some professional improvisers that first come to mind that are members of there are several groups. One, the True Fiction magazine, and another, Three for All. There are two small professional companies. These are improvisers in their 40s that have been doing it for 20 years, and they do long-form improv, in which they make up a whole three-act play on their feet from a single suggestion, playing all the characters on a bare stage. It's quite remarkable. They are phenomenal improvisers because they are highly attentive to each other and are creators in on their feet. But probably most of your listeners wouldn't have heard or known those players. I admire them more than someone who's well-known like Robin Williams, for example, because Robin Williams, I think, is, of course, a phenomenal improviser and comedian, but he's more of a one-man show. He takes the stage and basically creates everything within himself, whereas the thing I admire is what players do to riff off of one another. That, to me, is the one of the great things. To me, right now in politics, our current president, Obama, seems to me to be someone who is ultimately a realist, who's trying to really listen carefully to everything that's going on. In fact, that gets him into trouble because politics is often seems to be based on your having some fixed idea and doing only that, regardless of what's happening in the world. And he seems to have been criticized for sometimes changing a position, which strikes me as it ought to be a compliment, showing he is looking realistically at things that are going on. So I admire his realism and ability to try to listen and adjust to the changing landscape of our world. So those would be a couple that come to mind.
Yeah, I think I'm not familiar with the improv troupe you refer to, but absolutely with regard to the president, I think one of the things that attracts me to him is when he is interviewed is the answers aren't necessarily scripted.
Yes.
And while they maybe, you know, revolve around some talking points, generally he'll answer questions, which I appreciate. That's a good thing, I think. Whether people agree with the way he answers them or not from a point of view perspective, I think you can appreciate that ability to sort of approach life with some candor.
Mm-hmm. I'm certainly with you there. I like that because so much of politics is scripted, as you say, and to be able to think on your feet and answer coming out of the knowledge base that you have, but crafting a particular answer in the moment, which is what we do when we have this kind of a conversation. Our talk today is not scripted, and there were no questions proffered in advance. we're talking, and I think the benefit in that is, while the answers may not be perfectly sculpted, what they are is very much alive. I think you really mentioned that, too, in your Death by PowerPoint advice to speakers, that don't read your speech, for heaven's sakes. To me, that's one of the kisses of death in all public presentation is writing and then delivering your written speech as a reading. No matter what the content, that's the quickest way to put an audience to sleep. There's a different cadence to the read word than there is to basic human conversational speech. So I'd rather hear someone not being letter perfect who is speaking in sentences constructed from their mind rather than read from the page. It's sometimes hard to understand that the benefit of speaking rather than reading can outweigh what feels like the security of just standing up and reading your speech.
You know, as I'm thinking of some of my favorite examples of improvisation. I think of there's an album that comes to mind in particular, Kinda Blue by Miles Davis. Mm-hmm. I think it's unique in a couple ways. One is that you have a number of superstar performers. I mean, the legends of classical jazz music. Mm-hmm. Generally, when you put together a number of superstars, you get something that's much less than fabulous. You get mm-hmm. something that is, in essence, it's a bunch of people doing their own thing, highlighting themselves, as opposed to really collaborating.
But right.
I think Davis's approach to that album, where he sort of came in with really nothing more than, guys, here's the chord changes, let's play, and they hit record and went. And their respect for one another and sort of, you know, the ability to hand it off and really build on one another as opposed to try to sort of outdo one another.
Exactly.
Was really...
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Well, that's a perfect example. Of course, the whole methodology of improvisation comes from American jazz. That was really the first... One of the first improvisational forms of art, and it was really created in the United States. We can honor that as a truly American art form. The musicians, and you're right that the great ones are not only performers, solo performers, and musicians in their own right, but the fact of jazz is that ability to listen and change and develop something brand new through a cooperative and respectful way of working with others.
So cool,
isn't it?
One of the questions I have, sort of shifting gears, but is regard to education,
mm-hmm.
particularly with our kids. So kids are brought up to really sort of follow the rules. Improv is not necessarily something that's encouraged in a classroom environment. I learned that all too well growing up.
Yeah. I'm sorry to say that's true, yes.
How do we teach our kids discipline and sort of, you know, the reading, writing, arithmetic kind of part that requires, you know, discipline, focus, and really sort of, you know, rigorous, you know, repetition, while not beating out of them that, you know, I think we're all born as improvisers, and, you know, very quickly we're taught the word no, and from then on it's sort of beaten out of us through life.
Well, my solution would be that all schools actually taught improvisation as a subject. I know that's probably unrealistic, but it seems to me that there are certain subjects, of course, that require an approach that isn't necessarily using the rules of improv. And so you don't have to throw those out, but I think what you do have to do is offer instruction and guidance and teachers who understand the truth and the value of something like improv. I can imagine. I think that great teaching often comes from the understanding of this, regardless of the subject itself. But I would love to see improvisation classes in junior high school, colleges. At Stanford, for example, it's really one of the most popular courses. I'm no longer teaching in the undergraduate world, but so often I had the feedback when I was teaching that class that I'm so grateful to learn the system of improvisation to remind me of all these things that I'm going to need. So I think it's an add-on. We need improvisationally based kinds of classes and teaching along with the regular curriculum. I don't know quite how to make this happen, but it's certainly one of the things that's part of the mission of the rest of my life is how to get administrators and educators to understand this work and the value and find ways to include it.
Yeah, I think we spend so much time focused on the left brain, which is clear. I mean, it, it's very, very important. But so little time beyond, you know, the occasional art class of focusing on the right brain, of creativity and creation and, you know, improv.
That's true. No, perhaps if we manage to get through this recessionary glitch and we get back to a time when schools can expand.
Well, some technical difficulties. We dropped Patricia's call, but we will get her back on the line promptly. And we're back. You were talking about the economy recovers and educators are able to sort of expand curriculum again.
Uh-huh.
Where does that take us?
That's a good question. I don't really have a good answer for that, I don't think. I don't know. Part of my mission is actually talking to educators, and in the coming years, I'm going to be talking to businesses. I'm going to be trying to get a grant from Google and IDEO and some of the large think tank companies in Silicon Valley to endow a professorship, a chair, lectureship of improvisation and innovation at Stanford. Now, the point of this is much more important than just having an ongoing teacher of improvisation separate from some department. If Stanford, one of the leading universities in the country, sees that as an important thing to do, the idea that improvisation as a subject of study or that innovation is something that can be taught and learned could begin then to move down into other parts of the educational mindset. So I don't suspect that this, the goal to set up a chair of innovation and improv at Stanford necessarily is something that's on the plate of your listeners, but I would encourage everyone who cares about the things we're talking about to one, seek out in the community where they live, if there are groups or individuals who are teaching or performing improv, to support those groups, take classes in improv, try to understand more about how it works, and spread the gospel, if you will. That's certainly... a small thing that people can do is to pass on the literature. The book Impro by Keith Johnstone and my book, Improv Wisdom. I encourage folks to use the resources like these books that are around as well. So that's one possibility. And also just to start improvising your own lives. Say yes a little more. Make your partner look good. Be average. Make mistakes. Try stuff. And trust your own voice. That's the biggest message. We don't have to have some special knowledge to use what we already know in life, what is already obvious to us, to the benefit and service of others.
Well, Patricia, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your time today and sharing lots and lots of wisdom. Really encourage people to go out and pick up your book, Improv Wisdom, and to keep up with the latest and greatest things you're up to.
Thank you.
You're a fascinating person and certainly have enriched my life with your work. So I want to again say thank you.
You're wonderfully kind to invite me to this conversation today. I've so much enjoyed it. And I want to thank everyone for listening and you for taking the trouble to put this together and make it available. So have a great day there in Ohio, and I'm going to go and do some watercolor painting today.
Ah, wonderful. Well, thank you so much again, Patricia, and enjoy the painting.
You're welcome. Thanks, David.